Противостояние Коломойского и Порошенко началось
Петр Порошенко удовлетворил прошение Коломойского.
Игорь Коломойский очень умный и хитрый человек.
Коломойский прибыл к офису компании с отрядом вооруженных
людей. После этого Коломойский заявил, что будет активно бороться с ополченцами Донбасса.
Порошенко и Коломойский всячески подчеркивали, что у них нет никакого конфликта.
Чем вызван этот нынешний конфликт между Петром Порошенко и Коломойским?
Противостояние очень острое, в него вовлечено масса людей.
Завтра готовится
They got obscenely rich in the post-Soviet chaos. They leveraged their political contacts into wealth, and they leveraged their wealth into more political power. The most powerful among them are Russian speakers, but when the Russia-Ukraine conflict erupted, many sided with Kyiv, and they expected to be rewarded. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko's decision this week to sack Ihor Kolomoisky as governor of Dnipropetrovsk marks a new chapter in the Ukrainian authorities' relationship with the country's oligarchs. It also heralds the start of a tricky, dangerous, and perilous stage in Ukraine's post-Euromaidan efforts to build a law-based state. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me in the studio is Rostislav Khotin of RFURL's Ukrainian service. Welcome to the podcast, Rostislav.
Thank you.
And also joining us on the Skype line from Toronto is Taras Kuzio, a senior research associate at the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta. Welcome to the podcast as well, Taras. You're both here for the first time.
I've been here once.
Okay. Well, as we know, Poroshenko sacked Kolomoisky following a showdown over control of state oil companies. He accused Kolomoisky of using private militias to promote his business interests after armed men occupied the Kyiv headquarters of two oil companies. Now, there are a lot of balls in the air right now, so to speak. Kolomoisky's support for Kyiv was crucial in the early days after Euromaidan. He's also helped keep Dnipropetrovsk peaceful and keep it loyal to Kyiv. And he's also financed militias fighting pro-Moscow insurgents in the Donbass. At the same time, the Euromaidan uprising was largely about creating a law-based state. In a law-based state, oligarchs, of course, cannot use private armies to take over oil companies. My first reaction to all this week, the first thing that hit me when this happened was holy cow, was my first reaction. But it was, if things turn out well for Ukraine, this is going to be a watershed moment. It's going to be the moment when the state really began to rein in the oligarchs. And if things went badly for Ukraine, my first reaction was, this is going to be a watershed moment when things all went to hell in a handbasket. Taras, how do you see this moment? Is it a watershed?
I don't think so as much as maybe you would think, and there's a number of reasons for it. Firstly, of course, it was important that people like Kolomoisky, who has a very strong base in Dnipropetrovsk, from a regional and a Jewish, I mean, it's a big Jewish center, remember, in Dnipropetrovsk, that he's very influential in that community in Ukraine. But at the same time, Dnipropetrovsk does not have any support for separatism in that region. This is not a region that is likely to have pro-Russian sentiment. I mean, the two swing regions outside the Donbass are Kharkiv and Odessa, not Dnipropetrovsk. So it was crucial up to a point, but we will never know to what degree. I mean, his big mistake was not, this is why I'm not sure about the watershed, was not that he was corrupt. I mean, he's been controlling these two state oil institutions for at least the last decade, under three presidents. It was because he brought, stupidly, in a rash moment, his militia, or he thought his militia, into Kyiv. That's what was the red line. The red line wasn't the corruption, and that's what makes me a bit more coy about the question of corruption, because I still think we're in a situation of selective use of justice against the oligarchs. It's not a question of all the oligarchs under the spotlight now. It's a question of those who are not in power, like the Yanukovych people, the family, and those who haven't done deals with the authorities. So it's still sort of murky. And, Poroshenko's choices of prosecutor general have also not made me that sort of optimistic about, is this going to be a watershed moment? Are these going to be breakthroughs?
Yeah, so I guess you would be saying this is not the beginning of an effort to rein in the oligarchs. It was just Poroshenko telling Kolomoisky, you can't bring your private militias to Kiev without there being consequences.
I would say so, yes.
Which isn't a terribly high bar for a law-based state, right?
Well, I mean, you still have a situation where the only people who are criminally charged in Ukraine at the elite level, at the oligarch level, are people who are abroad. Firtash and Lazarenko were charged abroad by the Americans. If Firtash was still living in Ukraine, he would not be criminally charged. Mm. So, I mean, one has to be a bit suspicious and coy about these criminal charges. It's okay doing criminal charges against Yanukovych and the family. But for example, the criminal charges against them, because they're now living in Russia in exile. But they were doing this while Sergei Lyovochkin was chief of staff for all of the period of time Yanukovych was president, except for 1 month. So are we really going to be so naive not to think he didn't know this was going on? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He's not being touched. He's living in Kiev. He's a member of parliament.
Because he's playing ball.
Well, partly that, but partly because I don't think Poroshenko, who's cut from the same cloth, has it in him to go after oligarchs in general or to change the rules. I mean, he is a founder of the Party Regions back in 2000.
And he's an oligarch himself. He's a minigarch. Right.
Remember in 2004, Anders Aslan coined it millionaires versus billionaires. Right. And he's of the millionaires. So whether he's an oligarch, he doesn't have that clout like the Kolomoyskis and the Tarutas and Akhmetovs. But certainly, the key thing is changing the rules. And whether the oligarchs continue to like the question of very closeness of politics and business. You need to separate politics and business. My other reason why I'm a bit kind of, coy about and not very optimistic is that the Prosecutor General's office is, in my view, an institution that cannot be reformed. The USAID, the European Union, the Canadians have been trying to reform this Soviet institution for 25 years. It exists in Russia and Ukraine. This is an institution that defends the elites. It doesn't institute the rule of law. And so I don't see this institution as also playing a role in kind of bringing these elites and oligarchs to change their ways. So I think there's a number of factors here. It's Poroshenko is cut from the same cloth. He's also, I don't think he has the killer instinct, to put it very bluntly. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not a Timoshenko in that sense. But she might have gone overboard, but she had the killer instinct at least, especially against the gas lobby. So, I mean, it's a number of factors here at work. And the final thing here, which I think is really fascinating, is that let's remember that, you know, Ukraine this week, President Poroshenko this week, created an interagency task force to find the money that was stolen from Ukraine. The figures are ranging from, like 70 to 100 billion over Yanukovych's 4-year period. Now, a lot of this is, some of it's in Russia, but a lot of it's in the West. So the irony is that individual EU countries and their offshore zones helped Ukraine and helped Russian oligarchs to steal money. Yeah. So, when we're saying that, this money is now all dirty, well, it was always dirty. It was always earned corrupt. You know, Transparent International defines Ukraine in its rankings as the most corrupt country in Europe. That's been the case for the last 4 or 5, 6 years. So, but, this money wasn't put under due diligence when it arrived in Western Europe, Cyprus, Austria, Britain, you name it. And now all of a sudden it's become dirty. Do these governments not have access to Transparency International? Maybe they don't. Maybe the website's blocked in London or Cyprus.
No, it does seem that we're getting to this crucial inflection point, though, with this incident over this past week of whether the goals of the Euromaidan revolution, what people came out on the streets and died for, whether they're going to be fulfilled or not, or whether this is going to be just another case of like the old Who song, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. Rostislav, what was your thoughts this week? It was a pretty dramatic week. I mean, do you see a watershed, or do you share Taras's skepticism?
I think that oligarchs, they have a good instinct. They had the good kind of feelings where the wind blowing from and to. But they have on the level of a very high level of high business and high politics. But they don't have a feeling for the grassroots, what's going on the bottom of Ukrainian kind of. And Ukraine has changed actually from down from the bottom to the top. that was the whole mechanics of Maidan protests. You know, that Ukraine has changed on the bottom level from the average people, you know, and oligarchs haven't noticed. Yeah, yeah. The one of the main demands of the both Orange Revolution 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago, and last year in protests at Euromaidan in Kyiv, was to change the oligarchic system, which corrupts Ukraine, with which Ukraine can't be a modern European, modernized state, which prevents Western major companies to get into Ukraine, which doesn't allow Ukrainians to be spoiled with choice of goods and services. You know, it's overcharge, overpriced. Overpricing of. So this was the main one of the main reasons for Maidan protests. And the oligarchs, because of reasons I've just described, they haven't noticed this change at the bottom of Ukrainian society.
This is something we come to every time I do Ukraine on this podcast, and I do it. This is mainly a podcast about Russia, but we periodically do Ukraine. Every time we do Ukraine, we come to this point. At some point in the discussion, we talk about how Ukrainian society is so far ahead of the political elite and the economic elite. And at some point, and I think Rostislav raises a really good point here, Taras, that is a good counterpoint to your pessimism. Because no matter what Poroshenko wants to do, he is in power because those people went on the street and fought and died. And he is going to be facing pressure, and the political class is going to be facing political pressure to meet the demands of the Ukrainian street, if you will, of Ukrainian civil society, which is light years ahead of the political class. Do you think this gives us reason to think maybe we are heading towards some kind of watershed here?
I think both opinions are correct. I mean, they can be both correct, because there is this sort of, I'm kind of looking at it from the top down, and Rostislav's looking at it from the bottom up, as it were. And both,
I'm in the middle of you guys, literally.
Yes, you're the Ukrainian multi-vector.
That's a nice compliment.
But it is. But both views are correct. I absolutely agree that it's absolutely true that Ukrainian society, not just within Euromaidan, even before, is far more politically mature than Ukraine's ruling elites. Far more and less cynical. Far less cynical. There's a lot of cynicism in post-Soviet society in Eurasia. You know, Putin's an example of that, and the Ukrainian oligarchy elites and political elites are similar to that. And my only fear, though, is that the distractions, and I say this in a kind of a broad sense of what's happening in eastern Ukraine, the war, the conflict, destruction, the conflict with Russia, all of that, unfortunately, it takes energy away from what could potentially and would be the need for Ukraine's elites to take heed of Ukrainian civil society. Because Ukrainian civil society is, I think, getting to a point like it was in 2006 after the Orange Revolution. And by 2007, remember that Ukraine's society was very disillusioned with Yushchenko and Tymoshenko. So we're in 2006 mode now. But then there was no conflict and war. And they could, withdraw their political support from Yushchenko and Tymoshenko. They could organize protests. They could, civil society could become active. But that is, there's a restraint on that today because of what's happening in East Ukraine. I mean, Ukrainians will not go and do a second Euromaidan now because they think that will play into the hands of Russia. So that's where the problem is. And maybe Poroshenko and co. think that they will be able to get away with what they're doing. But, I mean, let's all, I think, probably agree as well that Poroshenko is likely to be a one-term president.
Yes.
I mean, it's the case anyway when West Ukrainians vote somebody in, whether it's Kravchuk, Yushchenko, they tend to be one-term presidents because West Ukrainians withdraw their vote from leaders when they're disillusioned. East Ukrainians don't. They keep on voting for the crook, Yanukovych. Poroshenko's at one term. Where it's going to affect people in terms of withdrawing political support is people like Yatsenyuk. Mm-hmm. Because Yatsenyuk is, to me, it sometimes feels as though when he was born, he first thing he said to his mother was, "I'm going to be the president of Ukraine." This is sort of arrogant ambition of his. And the popularity of his Popular Front, which was cobbled together very quickly and is funded by Kolomoisky, is now in the doldrums. So, you know, how is he going to come out of this in the next presidential election? So it's a mixed picture, as always, in Ukraine. Both views, you know, if you're looking at it from the bottom up, you'll see a very optimistic, you'll have a very optimistic view of Ukraine, as you say, especially in relation to Eurasia and especially in relation to Russia, where civil society is destroyed and been co-opted. But at the same time, Ukraine's elites, you know, Kolomoisky is a typical example of this. Let me just give you how it's kind of a very odd. You have a person who loves to live in Switzerland, so in the West, loves the luxuries of a rule of law-based state. He's always supported and financed pro-Western political forces, including Svoboda, by the way.
Yeah.
It's rather unusual for a Jewish Ukrainian, but there you are, West Ukraine. This is Ukraine, because he has oil interests in Ivano-Frankivsk. He's never supported East pro-Russian forces. At the same time, he only can exist in this Byzantine, Eurasian, you know, oligarchic closeness.
Well, can't he exist? And I actually would like to bring Rustlov in this too. I mean, didn't the decisive moment in that led up to the Euromaidan was when the Donbass oligarchs, most of them, decided in the summer of 2013 that they wanted the association agreement. Why did they want the association agreement? Well, because they didn't want to turn into little Hodorkovskys, basically. If Ukraine becomes an adjunct of Russia, their wealth is vulnerable. But if their wealth is in a European system, their wealth is safe. So it's a classic case. We got our money dirty. Now let's legitimize it and make it safe in a nice, safe Western system. So wasn't that the whole logic behind why the oligarchs supported Euromaidan?
Yeah, you know, first of all, we have to give praise to inverted commas to Ukrainian oligarchs, because unlike, for instance, Russian or Kazakh oligarchs, they have been living during the reign of five presidents in Ukraine, with different political backgrounds, opposing political camps. So it's not Kazakhstan or Russia, you know, they are used to the...
Yeah, there's elite plurality, there's oligarchic pluralism.
Yeah, they have this comfort zone in Russia and in Kazakhstan, you know, the authorities which stay for quite a long time. In Ukraine, the political system and political situation is changing very fast, and oligarchs got used to adjust themselves to the different kind of political situations. The first thing. Secondly, Ukrainian oligarchs are not pro-Russian and couldn't be pro-Russian because they don't want, first of all, to follow Hodorkovsky path, you know, and secondly, because they don't want to be, they are competitors with Russian oligarchic rivals. And this principle, also, they are very kind of, you know, their motto is that Ukraine should be pillaged by Ukrainians. Kind of, you know, we don't want anyone else, both Russians, we don't want Russian oligarchs here, but we don't also want Western big major companies as well in Ukraine. There is no competition.
But when it comes to a choice between the two, their support for the association agreement seemed to suggest to me that they preferred the Western competition to the Russian competition.
Yeah. Not competition. They prefer Western, probably Western values. They're already kind of rich enough to
legitimize
to secure their richness, to secure their wealth. First of all, because only Western rules, European rules, give protection to private property, you know, and all this stuff. They also frequent travelers to Europe, to the Western countries. They want to enjoy the kind of, and they want Ukraine, they see Ukraine future as a European civilized country, but the very existence of oligarchic system in its current shape prevents Ukraine from modernization.
So they're schizophrenic.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, schizophrenic. Actually, just yesterday, Kolomoisky was on Ukrainian TV channel saying that, asked whether there was a conflict between him and President Poroshenko. He said, no, there was conflict between Kolomoisky and Kolomoisky, between within myself.
You said that.
Yeah, as Kolomoisky, as an oligarch on one hand, businessman and a rich, powerful man. On the other hand, as Kolomoisky, as a state bureaucrat who has to run a big region, kind of state official. Kind of, there is,
well, that's,
but this reflects the whole kind of contradiction between them. During Ukraine's 24 years of Ukraine post-Soviet history, only one factory, new plant, was built in Ukraine. Only one. They are still sitting on the old Soviet rusty, industrial belt, which they do not invest. They do not modernize. They can't compete. Ukraine still imports high-octane petrol to Ukraine despite having 5 or 6 refineries. Yeah, right. Still imports from Romania and other European countries, because they do not...
Well, this is where you think they would want to take the next step, you would think, because you're right. The Ukrainian oligarchy has always been more, and we're going to talk about a little bit more about this in the second half, but the Ukrainian oligarchy's always been more pluralistic, and these guys are mixing with the European business class, and you'd think they want to take the next step. I mean, what about that? Taras, can the Ukrainian oligarchs themselves evolve?
Yes and no, but only if there's political will from the top. And it's imposed from the top. I don't think they'll ever do it on their own. And the reason, going back to the previous comment, is that the mindset in post-Soviet Eurasia is short-term. Yushchenko once described it as a momentocracy. So the idea that they're looking ahead to the fruits of being in the free trade agreement with the European Union, this is a medium to long-term. In the short-term, which is how they think, I can get more wealthier. And if you live in a system where the amount of capital you own defines your relationship to the political leader, which is the case, then whether you have 25 billion or 35 billion is important. Mm-hmm. And so I disagree that they think they've stolen enough. They will never think that until they're told from the top enough. To get an example, Kolomoisky was accused by other oligarchs of seeking to expand his business empire at their expense. Which he was doing. They will never think enough is enough until they're told enough by the political leader of the place. They're just too greedy. That's true of the whole lot of them throughout Eurasia. And just one final thing on the pro-Russian thing. Again, I'm not so sure it's true. On the whole, it's true that they are concerned about Russia. But the irony, and then Ukraine has many ironies, the only West Ukraine oligarch, Firtash, from Ternopil Oblast, is actually the most pro-Russian.
Yeah.
And there was a Reuters very big investigation of Firtash just a few months ago, which explained why he under Yanukovych, unlike Naftohaz Ukraini, was receiving very subsidized gas prices from Russia. Mm-hmm. He was getting it for about $250 per 1,000 cubic meters, which is only $100 more than Belarus, but certainly less than $450 what Ukraine was paying. And the reason was Russia was investing in their point man in Ukraine, who was using this money he was making to buy up parts of the economy for Russia. Mm. So Virtash, an example of a pro-Russian oligarch.
From the Akhmetov, West.
Yeah. Akhmetov also, up to a point, because him and Firtash gained the most, besides the family, under Yanukovych. And Akhmetov did finance some of the separatism in the early part of the campaign in Donetsk. So, I think we shouldn't be Pinchuk, sure, Taruta, sure, Kolomoisky, sure, pro-Western. But there are others who I think...
The others were on the fence, but none of them threw in whole hog with Russia. I mean, I was wondering if Akhmetov was, and I was watching Akhmetov very closely in the early days after Yanukovych's fall, and he didn't. He sat on the fence, which actually was enough. He dabbled with supporting the separatists in the beginning and then got cold feet. I want to give you three reasons why I'm actually optimistic. And this is what I play the role of the optimist in this podcast. I even have to do it when we're talking about Russia, which is a damn hard thing. It's getting harder and harder to do it. It's to the point where I can't really do it much anymore. But there's three reasons I'm optimistic at this moment for Ukraine. The first we've discussed is civil society. But the thing about civil society in Ukraine, yeah, it gets disillusioned. And Taras, you alluded to the 2006 business. But the thing about it is it just keeps coming back and back and back, more and more radical. The Ukrainian street in 2013, 2014 was more radical than the Ukrainian street in 2004 in the Orange Revolution, right? And I expect if they're disappointed again, they're going to come back angrier and more radical. And sooner or later, these people are going to take over. So that's number one. Number two, you mentioned the fact the distraction of the war right now. Well, if one of Russia's greatest weapons, not just in Ukraine, but everywhere, is corruption. It's the way they've spread a lot of money around Europe, corrupting Europe. Ukraine is more vulnerable to Russia. The proportion to which the degree to which Ukraine is vulnerable to Russia is directly in proportion with how corrupt Ukraine is. If Ukraine were not corrupt, the Russia threat would be minimalized, yes, right? Absolutely. So that's the second. That's the second reason. Third, you mentioned the political situation. Poroshenko, yes, is going to be a one-term president. The political map of Ukraine has changed dramatically. Mm-hmm. The old orange, and we had a whole podcast about this months ago, the old orange-blue divide is a thing of the past. It's gone. History. We don't know what's going to replace it, and especially now with Crimea, for all intents and purposes, taken out of the political map of Ukraine, parts of Donbass, for all intents and purposes, taken out of the political map of Ukraine, that only accelerates this process. Ukraine's going to keep electing pro-Western governments. It's just, mm-hmm. it's going to happen. So for these three reasons, I see reason for optimism. Maybe I'm a fool. Tell me I'm a fool, Rostislav.
I'm not a fool. I agree that there is a good chance. In that case, it's in a way, it's really a watershed. That now it's a good chance to reform Ukraine's political system and relations between state and oligarchs. The main mistake that Kolomoisky has made was that he challenged the state. He thought that the state is in a state of war.
He brought his armies to the capital.
And he ruled he's a state within state.
And he was very rude to our correspondent, I might add.
Yeah, so he challenged the state, which is in a state of war, and he lost. But the question is now whether Ukrainian authorities, president and the government are after Kolomoisky only, or they want rules for everyone else. The widely accepted clear rules for Ukrainian big businesses that they should know their place. No interference in political life of Ukraine. No kind of openness to competition. To clear the way to modernization of Ukraine and less corruption.
Don't you think if Poroshenko went after Kolomoisky, who let's face it, was the oligarch who was the most supportive of the new authorities in Ukraine, don't you think everybody else is also vulnerable? I mean, how have Renat Akhmetov, Viktor Pinchuk, how have they fared under the new authorities?
They are lying quietly. Akhmetov lost his political influence because Party of Regions is no longer there, which was the number one party during Yanukovych rule. He lost a lot of influence in the Donbass, where his conflict is going on. He lost a lot of businesses which are under occupied areas. Same with Firtash. He is no longer has big influence on presidential authority and on the government. He is very kind of linked to the previous regime. He's kind of, it's almost synonymous with the previous regime. So there is a good chance that other oligarchs are weakened by Maidan protests and Kolomoisky weakened by this new kind of short-lived right. six-day war, let's say.
Six-day war, that's yeah. I like that.
There was actually this drama was going over on for 6 days. Yeah, over 6 days. But it shouldn't be only the authority shouldn't be only after Kolomoisky. There should be clear, equal rules for everyone else. And secondly, that it's not just to please the West or to please the IMF. You know, it should be kind of the change of the system, relations between states and oligarchs is interest of Ukraine.
Yes, this is not about the West and the IMF. Yeah. This is for Ukraine.
Absolutely,
this is good for Ukraine, and the society certainly realizes it. What do you before we move on to the second section, Taras? What do you think about that? I mean, if Poroshenko is going to go after Kolomoisky, what's to stop him from going after Akhmetov, Pinchuk, Firtash, anybody else who is not as supportive of him as Kolomoisky was?
He's not going after Kolomoisky. I mean, let's unpack this.
He fired him.
He fired him. Big deal for him. It's not a big deal for Kolomoisky. He fired him. They reached an amicable agreement. If I would understand Poroshenko going after Kolomoisky, if he criminally charged him for stealing money from Ukrnafta and elsewhere for the last 10 years, he's not doing that. All of his sins, if Kolomoisky is telling the truth in the London court that he was paying Pinchuk $5 million a month as a consultancy fee, so called, so that he could then control Ukrnafta, think how much he was making himself. It had to be more than $5 million a month over the last 10 years. He's not getting into trouble for that. Nobody, you know, the only people that I see potentially criminally charged now are Yefremov and Chechetov, the leaders of the party regions, one of whom committed suicide recently. But we'll see where they go. You know, Ukraine has, the prosecutor's office in Ukraine has a reputation over the last 20 years. It opens criminal files, and then they go nowhere. They never, and I could list for the next hour names of people they've investigated, and they've, because the prosecutors get bribed to close the case. I mean, this is how it's always been done. So let's see. Now, Poroshenko could say, okay, let's forget the past, draw a line, and then from now on, everybody has to play by the rules. So we're not going to necessarily go after people prior to now, except maybe the people under Yanukovych's regime. To me, what the key thing is that, will they stop interfering in politics? Well, that's easier said than done. Ukraine doesn't, throughout Eurasia, including Ukraine, political parties are not ideological.
Mm-hmm.
And this makes them very different to Eastern Europe and the Baltic states, which means that they tend to be formed as virtual parties. There isn't a real political party anywhere in Ukraine today.
They're all personality-based or oligarch-based.
And,
yeah.
Therefore, to get business out of politics means political parties have to stop taking money from oligarchs. And they all did. The communists did. Tymoshenko did.
Mm-hmm.
I disagree with Rostislav about Firtash. Firtash has influence in 3 out of 6 political forces in the Ukrainian parliament. Poroshenko bloc, the radical party, and the opposition bloc. Poroshenko and Klitschko went to see Firtash in March to get his blessing, in Vienna, to get Klitschko to drop out of the race for Poroshenko. To say that he's now out of the picture is not necessarily the case. And the only reason he's out of the picture potentially is because the Americans are criminally charging. The Austrians have nothing on him. The Ukrainians have nothing on him. And it's all rests
on... But he's weakened. Weakened.
I mean, he is not out of picture, but he should be, as Koloma and others, kind of not out of picture completely, but to know their place, kind of. There should be division between politics and...
There should be,
sure. There should be common rules for everybody else, not just for Kolomoisky. You know, it should be in pick-up. Firtash should be also playing by the rules, and Akhmetov and others.
And you're saying the Kolomoisky thing might be a precedent for the others, and Taras is saying, we'll just fire him is no big deal. It's a big deal if he charges him criminally, which is impossible right now, quite frankly, given with the war going on.
Yaman, this situation with Kolomoisky is kind of important because if a person with such political influence in the new post-Maidan Ukraine is not safe from kind of after challenging the very state, despite he is viewed by a lot of people as a savior of Ukraine.
This is the paradox.
Yeah, because he's created this bastion against Russian separatism in the east and save actually
And he is revered in Dnipropetrovsk.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just looked at the excellent report your service did on this from the ground in Dnipropetrovsk.
And Dnipropetrovsk region is not the average Ukrainian region. It's one of the most powerful, big industrial, agricultural, and political base, and traditionally which produced a lot of for Ukrainian Soviet elite, personalities. So if a person with such, background, with such baggage as a savior of Ukraine is not safe from, authorities, so others should be also think twice before, have to behave in new Ukraine. But again, we are talking about that it shouldn't be just Kolomoisky should be picked up solely. It should be everyone, rules for everyone, clear, transparent rules in modern European Ukraine, yes.
Okay, well, in a few moments, we will continue our discussion and wonder about the hand of Moscow in all of this and contrast ways in which Ukraine's struggle to rein in its oligarchs contrasts with that of its northern neighbor. I'd like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me in the studio here in Prague is Rostislav Potin of RFRL's Ukrainian service. And joining us on the Skype line from Toronto is Taras Kuzio, a senior research associate for the Ukrainian Institute for Canadian Institute for Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at RFRL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
From the point of view of Ukrainian politics, the most important issue, the central issue, the issue, is getting from what I call oligarchical pluralism to real pluralism. So Ukraine is an oligarchical country. It really is a country where there are, you know, there are a half dozen oligarchical clans who control a huge proportion of the national wealth. And the question, the real question there is, and this is a question that America faced, of course, right, 130 years ago, how you get from that to real pluralism, not just competition among clans, but actual democratic competition among larger pluralist groups. And that's what this revolution was actually about.
That was Professor Timothy Snyder, the prominent Yale University historian, speaking in Chicago in November about what the Euromaidan revolution was all about and what we were discussing in the first half. And I want to, and another reason why I'm optimistic, it's all what you're contrasting it to, right? And as you look at how Ukraine got to this point, it's hard not to contrast the country's post-Soviet development with Russia's post-Soviet development. Both of these countries came out of the Soviet rubble, and they developed in radically different ways. They were separated at birth, so to speak, in a lot of ways. As I've noted here on the podcast, on the blog, on the Daily Vertical, the differences emerged almost from the start. In Russia's first post-Soviet political crisis, Boris Yeltsin shelled the parliament into submission. In Ukraine's first post-Soviet political crisis, President Leonid Kravchuk held an early election, lost, and left power. That was in 93 and 94, respectively. Ever since, Ukraine has had competitive elections in which incumbents have routinely lost. And you noted this, Rostislav, the oligarchs have had to learn to live under a lot of different regimes. In Russia, every election's been a stage-managed affair in which the incumbent or the incumbent's handpicked successor has won. Ukraine's elite is pluralistic. Russia's is monolithic and obedient. Ukrainian civil society, as we've noted, is vibrant, independent, and getting stronger by the day. Russia's been either repressed or co-opted. And as Professor Snyder noted, what's going on now with the Euromaidan revolution is that Ukrainian society is demanding that its leaders take the next and most difficult step in this transition, transitioning from a oligarchic pluralism to real pluralism. And if they succeed, it would mark another interesting and very consequential and maybe the final contrast, the final break with Russia. Let's listen to Professor Snyder one more time to get the discussion rolling.
In Russia, the current regime, for better or for worse, and there are ups and downs to each side, succeeded in crushing post-communist oligarchy and bringing it to heel and in creating a centralized state in which there are clans, but all the clans are beholden, at least for the time being, to the presidency, that is, to the regime of President Putin. This means that civil society in Ukraine, or a revolution in Ukraine, or a protest in Ukraine, was a threat not only to the Ukrainian order, but a threat in a different way to the Russian order.
This is crucial, actually. What Professor Snyder says here is crucial, because what happened in Ukraine was a threat not just to the Yanukovych and his family and the ruling pro-Moscow clique at the time. It's a threat to Russia because of the example it would set, and because of the it would be damaging to business interests of Russia's oligarchy, which is all under the control of the Kremlin. You can't even really call it an oligarchy; it's a controlled oligarchy. And something I can't help but wonder here, I haven't seen any evidence of it, is there a hand of Moscow in all of the pre-Kolomoisky, post-Kolomoisky oligarchic situation we have right now? Or is Russia just sitting back and watching because the chaos benefits it?
I think there is a kind of tendency now to see
the hand of
everywhere,
Moscow everywhere.
Everywhere. You know, Moscow,
there's a funny joke about Mikhail Saakashvili that I will not tell on the air.
He is not.
No. It's a different joke. But there is such a tendency
to see Moscow hands everywhere, and the first thing which Kolomoisky made in a statement after leaving in the night, you know, the Ukrtransnafta.
Russian. No, he was saying it was Russians.
Russians again, yeah.
But Russia does benefit from this.
Yes, you have to wonder,
and they still have influence with some of these oligarchs.
Yeah.
So I don't think we're being hyper-conspiratorial here.
But of course, the messier, the more messy Ukraine is, it's to Russia's benefit.
And the less oligarchized Ukraine gets, the more it's to Russia's benefit.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Russia has an interest in this situation.
Yeah, but if you,
and levers.
We talked about Ukrainian and Russian oligarchs. In Russia, it seems that oligarchs are rather appointed. You know, you're going to be oligarchs here. You got your billions. In Ukraine, there are sharks, which
oligarchs can be fired not just as governors of regions in Russia. They can be fired as oligarchs in Russia.
Yes, that's true. In Ukraine, they are sharks who survived, you know, during different political regimes, who made actually, they are brainier, they made their money, you know, in different difficult circumstances, you know, and they managed to preserve their wealth as well. So they are swimming for a long time, over 20 years almost. So, but in Russia, the situation is very different.
And these Ukrainian sharks, these oligarchs, they're very familiar with the very big shark that's to the north of Ukraine, and they know how to deal with it to navigate it, and to a degree have been co-opted by it, but to a degree not, as we've pointed out.
That's why the membership of Ukraine in the European Union, the move of Ukraine towards the Western club will benefit oligarchs. That's why they're in favor of this move, to protect themselves, to protect their wealth, you know. But it also comes with a different political system, you know. European Western system is a little bit different. It's not America of Rockefellers, you know what I mean. So they should adjust themselves to the new rules, to the more open economy, to competition, to the need of modernization of Ukraine, because otherwise Ukraine will be still remain a gray zone between Europe and Russia.
Well, this is the thing too. I mean, the battle for Ukraine is not just going to be won on the battlefields of Donetsk. The Ukraine's battle with Russia is going to be won largely to the degree that it solves this problem. You mentioned the Rockefellers. If the Ukrainian oligarchs do go the route of the Rockefellers and the Carnegies that they went in America and make that transition from being robber barons to being civic actors, very important civic actors, I might add. Rockefeller and Carnegie didn't stop being rich when they stopped being robber barons, but they just had to play by a different set of rules. So, Taras, how do you see this? I mean, do you see? I just, if I were in Putin's shoes, I don't know what I'd be doing here, but I would certainly be trying to exacerbate this situation to prevent the de-oligarchization, if that's a word I can use, of Ukraine, as much as I'm trying to disrupt the Donbass, right? I mean, wouldn't it be logical?
Well, of course. I mean, you know, Edward Lucas says that Russia's biggest export has always been corruption.
And its biggest weapon is corruption.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I mean, but both to the European Union countries and to Eurasia.
Yes.
Both. But, you know, I think that when I look at Ukrainian and Russian political ways of doing things, Ukrainians are going to be more like, I'm half Ukrainian, half Italian. I mean, my mother's Italian. So I see far more similarities for Ukraine to Southern Europe than to Anglo-Saxon Northern
Certainly,
Europe.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, Ukraine's more likely to be like Italy or Greece than to Germany or Sweden. And in that sense, you know, there are oligarchs in Italy and Greece, even though they're both members of the EU. So, and oligarchs did a terrible job in making Greece bankrupt. But on the question of threats, what were the threats? I think, and going back to the comparison Russia-Ukraine, I think it's all down to national identity. Russia never declared independence from the USSR, and in the USSR, Russian and Soviet identity were intertwined, which they still are today. It's called Eurasianism now, but it's basically Russian and Soviet.
Same animal, yeah.
Same animal. And that kind of identity was also very strong in the Crimea and Donbass, where surveys always said that Soviet identity was more popular in those two regions, than Russian and Ukrainian, and those were the only two regions of Ukraine where Soviet identity was on top. And so when we talk about Dnipropetrovsk, we should realize that it's very, although it's borders Donetsk, it's very different in its identity.
Yeah.
If you go around the villages of Dnipropetrovsk, they speak Ukrainian. You know, it's a mixed picture. And Tymoshenko in 2007 got 30% of the vote, with a big increase in places like Dnipropetrovsk. So it's very different to Donbass. So on the question of I think identity. But The difference, though, and the comparison we should be making is not just with Russia. It's with very bad reforming and corrupt countries of Eastern Europe, like Romania, Bulgaria, Serbia. These also were countries with national minority problems, with revanchist anti-European parties that didn't want those countries to go west, anti-revolutionary parties, shall we say. And these countries were able to overcome their internal inheritances mm-hmm. from Ceausescu and others and from their anti-revolutionary parties because they had the membership peg to go to the European yeah. Union. Ukraine doesn't have that. It's never been offered membership. The Eastern Partnership, even though Putin made a big deal out of it and began to oppose it, the Eastern Partnership never offered membership to anyone.
No, it was a necessary but not sufficient first step.
Right. And this is ironic. And this is why people like Andrew Wilson call it EU enlargement light.
Right.
I mean, it's ironic because Ukraine has an even worse legacy from the USSR than Romania and Bulgaria. And yet it doesn't have the membership peg that they have. And so it's going to be a big task. You know, I mean, it's that membership peg hanging over you that forces you to clean up things. It's far less political will. I mean, the two combined are
well,
great.
Well, they reinforce each other. And actually, I mean, your comments to us actually made me think of something that I was listening to this lecture by Professor Snyder as I was preparing for this podcast. And one of the things he pointed out in that podcast is for 80% of Ukrainians, I didn't realize the number was this high, 80% of Ukrainians self-identify as Europeans. 80%. Yeah. You know what the number is in Russia? Eight.
Wow.
Eight. So for Russia, Europe is something to be contrasted with. And if we're Ukraine, there's no question of contrasting yourself with Europe. The social base is there.
No anti-Americanism.
Taras mentioned, you know, this division between Northern and Southern Europe. It's within the European Union. But I would like to point out that there is a division between those in New Europe. Which part of this New Europe Ukraine wants to be? In the European Union, Ukraine wants to be Poland and Baltic states, which has similar identities as well with Lithuania, with Poland. Or Ukraine wants to be part of the southern New Europe, Bulgaria and Romania. You
this
know.
Is actually...
There are different Ukraines.
I've had thoughts on this. I mean, if things go well for Ukraine, there's not just one option. There's a lot of options.
Yeah.
The very best, like the ultimate dream is that Ukraine turns into Poland.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
Highly unlikely, but that's the ideal. That's the goal. Somewhere in the middle, it's something like Slovakia. My guess is the mm-hmm. best thing we could hope for is Ukraine becomes like Bulgaria.
And hopefully not Greece.
I took three Slavic countries here for a reason.
At Munich Security Conference recently, I've been there. There was one leader of the EU country who said that the whole thing about Ukraine for Russia, for Putin, for Kremlin, is not about preventing Ukraine to join European Union or to join NATO. It's about preventing Ukraine to become Poland inside, to build Poland, you know, a successful, reformed, modernized right. economy and country, society right. inside Ukraine. That's the whole thing about Ukraine conflict and Russian aggression.
Well, yeah, if they become like Poland, they will have succeed. I mean, that is the best we can hope for. I think the likely thing is that you're going to have something like Bulgaria, which isn't a bad thing. I mean, Bulgaria is a EU country with its problems, with its corruption, but it's in the European Union.
Ukraine is very diverse regionally, and some regions are very close mentally, historically to South Balkans, like Odessa, for instance, or Crimea, or, you know, others for more than a century were part of Austria-Hungary, right. elected deputies, you know, MPs to all via
all,
parliament.
All of what is Ukraine, you know, was in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth.
Absolutely. So it's kind of that enriches Ukraine. That makes Ukraine a very diverse and rich country. And Ukraine could be simultaneously both Poland, Slovakia, Hungary,
Bulgaria,
Lithuania.
Lithuania.
Yes, yeah, anyway, yeah. yeah. But I don't think it's a threat to Ukraine. It's rather enriches it and makes it a very rich and diverse country.
Do you think the Russia threat, going back to this whole thing of like this battle is going to be won on de-oligarchizing the Ukrainian economy, essentially, in the Ukrainian political system? And if I'm seeing this, they got to see this in Kyiv. I mean, even the elite, which is so far behind the political class, they have to see this. Do you think the threat from Russia, which was latent before, but let's just say it's become manifest with a vengeance in the last year, don't you think this is going to push them to, it could push them to finally do this? My last attempt at optimism today.
No, I mean, I don't like the words optimism, pessimism. It's realism, but I think it's a number of things. I mean, I don't think for Putin it's just a question of what kind of system emerges in Ukraine and whether it's oligarchic or not. I mean, you know, if you deal with the oligarch question, as all economists will tell you, Anders Aslan and everybody else, you can deal with the questions of Ukraine's stagnant economic growth. I mean, Ukraine's economy is still less in size than the Soviet Ukrainian economy of 89, before the USSR disintegrated. Right. It's still smaller. So you've really had, with changes of political leadership, you've had musical chairs. I mean, and people just taking the same amount from the same pie.
Right.
The pie hasn't grown. So you need to unleash that potential. Yeah. Ukrainians are good.
Yes, Ukrainians are great entrepreneurs, and this pie could
Toronto,
grow.
When they arrive in Toronto, they become regular businessmen that they can't do in Ukraine.
Not to mention Chicago.
Yeah, and the shadow economy in Ukraine is stable. It's been stable since the 90s, 50% of GDP, which puts Italy to shame. That's 25% in Italy or Greece. In Ukraine, it's 50%. You need to create, which is where I agree with you and Rostislav about the civil society. What that was all about in Orange Revolution, Euromaidan, was a revolution of dignity. They wanted to be treated as citizens. They wanted a new contract with the ruling elites of the country. There was never a contract. There isn't one in Russia. Russia despises its population, the Russian leadership.
They fear their population is what they do.
And for that to happen, when that happens, then the shadow economy will go down because Ukrainians don't pay taxes.
It'll be brought out of the shadows. And
right. At the lower levels, Ukrainians withdraw from official. They don't pay taxes. They go into the shadow economy. At the highest level, the money's sent abroad to Western mm-hmm. Europe. And then Ukraine budgets perennially broke and looking to the IMF. Size of the economy, economic growth. Ukraine's small and medium business sector, which is primarily West Central Ukraine, is very small by European standards. It's about 12-13% of GDP, when it should be up to 30-40%. You know, the shadow economy and also Western Europe be more critical in due diligence and money being exported from Ukraine and opening up those Swiss bank accounts. But I think for Putin, it's also a question. It's not just what kind of system it is. You know, he was angry that the man he chose to be his Kadyrov in Ukraine, Yanukovych, was overthrown. And he really did see him as his, he bribed, you know, Putin is a cynic. So he thinks ideology is not important. You just throw money at Kadyrov or Yanukovych and they jump into line. In Ukraine, that only works for certain people like Yanukovych. But for many people, there's ideas, ideology, Europe.
Well, yeah. And Yanukovych was under pressure from his very own oligarchs to sign that agreement. Rostislav, last word to you before we wrap it up because we're pushing up against the end.
I think it's a good chance now, the turning point for Ukraine to build the oligarchize Ukraine, kind of, you know, to build a civilized relation between state and big business. And Russia should also watch it carefully because Russia doesn't know how to build relations between state and oligarchs, between state and big businesses in Russia, kind of in a civilized way. You know, you either go to jail or you are appointed and you are a friend of, you know what I mean?
No.
If Ukraine will be able to do, to construct a decent, civilized, modern system of relationship between big business and the state, it will benefit Russia as well. Russia could copy them later, you know.
No, there was somebody who was, I remember, trying to do this in the 90s when I was working as a correspondent in Russia. His name was Boris Nemtsov, who was the deputy prime minister in part of the 90s. Mr. Nemtsov, of course, failed in that effort, not for a lack of trying. And he was assassinated 1 month ago today. This was something I wanted to make note of. And on that note, I guess we can wrap it up for today because we're bumping up against a time wall. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me in the studio here in Prague has been Rostislav Hotin of RFURL's Ukrainian service. And joining us on the Skype line from Toronto has been Taras Kuzio, a senior research associate for the Canadian Institute for Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening, lively, and fascinating discussion.
Thank you.
I also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable and awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the newly launched Daily Vertical at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.